From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from tattoo artist and historian Don Ed Hardy. He learned his craft in the tattoo parlors of Southern California. And speaking of Southern California, Sally Field got her start in the TV series Gidget, and it took a while for her career to recover. Field is starring in the new movie Eye for an Eye. We'll hear an interview from our archives about her early career. And we have an interview with Hollywood legend Lauren Bacall about her early career and her marriage to her first leading man, Humphrey Bogart. We heard from their son, Stephen, yesterday. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dead Man Walking. That's all coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The winter storm dumping more snow in the eastern states has forced airports in Baltimore and Washington to close and is causing flight delays at New York's airports. At Washington's Dulles Airport, a ValueJet DC-9 got stuck in a snowbank after landing and had to be towed out. Roads are also hazardous in the region. Two buses collided head-on this morning on a snow-covered highway in Pittsburgh, killing one person and injuring at least 52. NPR's James White has more on the situation in the nation's capital.
It's deja vu for federal workers, school children, and some travelers as today's winter storm left the Washington area closed down and slowed down the local transportation system. James Hardwick is a Washington nurse. He waited over 45 minutes for a bus to take him to work. Because of the weather, he'll likely put in a few extra hours.
I'll have to work a double shift, I'm sure, because many people will not be coming in today because of this. And people who do rely on buses and the metro, it's not always the best source of reliable transportation.
Well, what do you think of this weather so far?
Being the good Christian that I am, I'm not allowed to say what I think.
The storm is expected to leave as much as a foot of snow throughout the mid-Atlantic and Northeast. I'm James White in Washington.
Chechen rebels surrounded by Russian forces in a village near the border with Chechnya have freed a few more of their hostages, but they're still holding over 100 people captive. The rebels want a guarantee of safe passage back to their homeland. Russia is insisting that all of the hostages must be freed first. To reinforce the point, Russian helicopter gunships buzzed the village today. Federal authorities are investigating a new twist that may be associated with the firebombing of an interracial church in Knoxville, Tennessee. Kim Smith of member station WUOT reports.
Letters vowing a reign of terror on interracial relationships in the city have begun showing up at a number of businesses. One of the businesses is the Knoxville Community Investment Bank, founded by Green Bay Packers star Reggie White. The bank provides startup money for minorities who want to start small businesses. White is also an associate pastor at Inner City Church. The 400-member interracial church was firebombed Monday. In addition to investigating the firebombing, the FBI and ATF are also trying to determine who wrote the letters and if there is a link between them and the firebombing. The Inner City Church is the fifth predominantly black or interracial church to be set on fire in less than a year in Tennessee. Officials say there is no connection between the cases. For National Public Radio, I'm Kim Smith in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Israel and Syria have agreed to bring military experts to the table and to step up the pace of their negotiations when peace talks resume in Maryland in 2 weeks. Secretary of State Warren Christopher made the announcement today in Syria. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 23 points at 5,042. This is NPR News. President Clinton has appealed to Bosnia's ethnic factions to join those who open their arms rather than those who still clench their fists. Mr. Clinton made the remarks in a videotaped message for broadcast within hours after his arrival this weekend in Bosnia to visit U.S. troops. Speaking at a truck assembly plant in Nashville this morning, the president said the U.S. role in the Bosnian peacekeeping mission is part of America's unavoidable role of leadership in the cause of peace, democracy, and freedom around the world. California's tax board has decided to stop imposing sales taxes on political cartoons and comic strips sold to newspapers, magazines, and comic syndicates. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Cartoonist Paul Mavridis spent the last 5 years fighting the California tax board, arguing that he and other freelancers should not have to collect sales taxes for the state when selling their artwork. After numerous appeals, the tax board agreed to refund Mavridis $1,000 in back sales taxes he owed the state. Mavridis says he's elated by this and with the board's decision to change its longstanding policies.
Rewriting the regulation for exempting authors will basically acknowledge cartoonists and comic creators as authors who trade in ideas and speech rather than tangible property.
Mavridis says now all cartoonists will be exempt from California sales taxes. I'm Mandalit Del Barco in Los Angeles.
A Japanese court has turned down a request by the mother of one of the Marines on trial for raping a schoolgirl to have the proceedings moved off the island of Okinawa. Kendrick Ledet's mother said public anger over the crime has made a fair trial there impossible. Ledet and a fellow Marine claim Navy Seaman Marcus Gill bullied them into abducting the girl, and they claim they only pretended to rape her. Gill says all three took part in the assault. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. Tattoos inspire strong reactions. Tattoos can be magical or menacing, spiritual or macho. Some people get them for their beauty, some for the power to shock. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Don Ed Hardy, a tattoo artist, painter, and tattoo historian who has been an important figure in the broader recognition of tattoos as an art form. He opened his studio in San Francisco in 1974. In 1986, he moved to Honolulu and began publishing books on the history of tattooing and the work of tattoo artists. He's also organized several exhibitions of tattoo art. He co-curated a show of tattoo designs called Pierced Hearts and True Love, A Century of Drawings. It's now at the Williams College Museum of Art in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and will travel later this year to Miami, San Francisco, and Cincinnati. When I spoke with him last year, Hardy described the images on his own body as a conglomerate collection of Western traditional tattoos and large Japanese epic mythological torso tattoos.
I have an image of a ghost on my back from an 1840s print by Utagawa Kuniyoshi, one of the most famous of the ukiyo-e school Japanese printmakers. I have two Buddhist protectorate gods, a male and a female, divinities on my ribs that were also done in Japan. I've got a little cartoon 1940s duck on my arm. That's my current favorite tattoo that I got on my last birthday from my son, who's also a tattoo artist. I have a Buddhist rosary tattooed on my wrist that was done in Japan. A whole variety of images. There's a lot of things. Some are just kind of goofy souvenir things, little memorial pieces.
How does the cartoon duck get along with the more spiritual images?
I think it fits right in. It's kind of a great Zen tattoo. I've got a woman's face on my right arm, kind of in the bend of the arm, with My Life is a Dream in Spanish, Mi Vida es un Sueño. And it's this kind of like beautiful, surreal, you know, semi-serious design. And then I had this space on my left arm that I've been saving for years. And this duck is pointing at himself and saying, "Who me?" It's called the Who Me Duck, and it was a very popular kind of kitsch tattoo in during World War II, and I've always loved it just because it's so dopey. So I think it's a great kind of sobering counterpoint to the, you know, grandiosity of some of the other stuff.
It sounds like you've turned your body into something of a museum.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if you also feel that some of the images tattooed onto your body offer you any kind of protection almost.
Yeah, I think that essentially all tattooing is sort of psychic armor, whether it's acknowledged by the people wearing them or not. But I think that's a lot of the intent behind it, to make people feel stronger and better about themselves. And of course, it's just sort of a form of play, you know, dress up too. And I love my tattoos. I've never regretted getting them. Came into this thing very early in life and was just very attracted to it. So I think they're great. The only drawback to tattoos is that you do run out of space. It's not like collecting other
exactly.
things.
Exactly. So. Are you out yet?
Yeah, well, no, I'm not totally tattooed, and
what's
I probably
left?
Never will be. So
what's left?
I've got a lot of space on my legs, and kind of figure, like a friend of mine in the business says, well, it's like money in the bank, you know, having that open skin. So, you never know if you might want to find something that's, you know, seems like the right time to have something else put on.
Now, you've said that the process of applying a tattoo is so magical. The images have real power.
Mm-hmm.
What's magical and powerful about it?
Well, I think there's a lot of the fact that it is permanent, and the fact that a person is making a great commitment when they decide to become tattooed and are dealing with social forces, either positive or negative, depending on your society. In our society, it's been so marginalized and has so many negative connotations that it's took a sort of courage or single-mindedness, I think, for people to decide to be tattooed. I think there's just kind of a lot of psychological energy that gets involved with that, and you know, it's up to the artist to hopefully do their very best to transmit the kind of feeling that the person wants with the image, to make the process as easy as possible. And it's just a very key kind of a thing. I think that the doing of a tattoo, I was attracted to it. I got into tattooing ultimately from a fine arts background, and I was a printmaker, and I liked the finality of etching, of working on metal plates. But the finality of tattooing impressed me as a much more dramatic kind of art form. It was the most challenging medium that I could see.
What were the images that were popular when you started to get interested in tattooing? And you could tell us how old you were and what year that was. Mm-hmm. You know, put us in a context.
Yeah, I was. I reconnected with tattooing. I really got interested in tattooing in 1955 when I was 10. My mm-hmm. best friend's dad had tattoos. I thought it was the greatest kind of picture making I'd ever seen, and I began investigating these tattoo parlors that were about 20 miles north of where I grew up in Southern California. And I was too young for anyone to teach me, so I had a little toy tattoo shop I was doing with colored pencils on neighborhood kids, and that went on for about 3 years, and then I gave it up because I was too young to really get an apprenticeship in a tattoo shop. So I reconnected in 1966 when I was 21. I was finishing my undergraduate work at the San Francisco Art Institute. And the images then, the only things available were very traditional Americana things, hearts, daggers, eagles, sailing ships, religious images, cartoons. It was an image bank that had become codified by about the 1920s and remained virtually unchanged. I was interested in that as a kind of an American folk art form that no one had really looked at closely. And as I approached it from that side and thinking, well, this is kind of interesting kitsch, and remembered everything I'd learned about it when I was a little kid, a tattoo artist actually showed me a book of photos of Japanese tattooing, which featured much more designs that fit the body, larger scale designs, and the imagery was so much more sophisticated and based on classical Japanese myths and ukiyo-e pictorial forms. And I thought I was so blown away by the possibilities of it as a medium. That's what led me to want to get into it. I thought, well, if they can do it there, we could certainly develop this as a medium here in the West.
You in fact, studied with a Japanese tattoo master in mm-hmm. Japan.
Yeah, I eventually was able to go. I began tattooing in 1966 and then really had my first professional shop at the beginning of 1968. And in 73, I was able to move to Japan and live there for about 6 months working with a traditional tattoo master. And it was an incredible experience because it's a very, very hermetic culture over there, very private.
What was his philosophy?
Basically, he saw himself as the heir to a great tradition, Japanese decorative tattooing. The current solid era of it goes back to about 1800. He thought that he was very much continuing the lineage, the artistic aesthetics of the 19th century printmakers and the great 19th century tattooers. He was still applying most of his tattoos with hand tools, basing his images on the woodcut prints of that era. And so he was very, very much aware of his place in history, of continuing as a repository of Japanese mythology and symbolism, a lot of things in the traditional arts that have really died out among most parts of that society.
You know, I think of tattooing in America as being associated with macho, you know, guys mm-hmm. at sea, guys mm-hmm. in prison, the mermaid on the muscle on your arm or the mermaid on your stomach, I mm-hmm. guess. So when mm-hmm. when you move your stomach, the mermaid moves, or, you know, a tattoo on a muscle on your arms, when you flex your muscle, a tattoo moves. But it's a real macho culture. I bet that's not what it was in Japan.
No, it was in Japan.
It was
very, macho? Yeah. I think it was very, and there again, it was very much done as for an amuletic purpose. I think traditionally mm-hmm. The firemen, who were very, very important figures, real neighborhood heroes in Edo and, you know, the old-time Tokyo, where all the buildings were paper and wood and fires would spring up and they were very serious business. So you'd have these fire brigades that were heavily tattooed and they would throw off their kimonos when they go to fight the fire and display these dragons and other kind of protective deities tattooed on them. And they were the great dandies of the town and, you know, very brave people. So it definitely has that connotation over there. In fact, there are very few women even today that are tattooed in Japan, which is not the case in the West. I think in the West now, certainly in urban centers, New York, London, Paris, and, you know, San Francisco and all that, women make up more than half of the clientele.
I've always thought of women's tattoos as having these very chauvinistic roots. I mean, the cliche is either, a lovely little rose by a sexual part of your body,
mm-hmm.
Or a butterfly,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, on the other side, I guess this is from biker culture, the kind of Bob's girl tattoo by
right.
your pubic hair or
right.
something,
right.
or on your behind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that women's tattoos are becoming less male defined like that?
Definitely. Definitely. I think some of the most interesting and, incredible, unusual creations that are being commissioned are on women and often by women tattoo artists.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember, too, that because tattooing has been so marginalized, that many of these cliches were only the most public, the most visible aspects, the tip of the tattoo iceberg of the kinds of people who were flamboyant enough to be strutting this kind of thing and, you know, basically loudmouth and whatever about their tattoos in public. So you get, you know, biker chicks and hog riding fools and then, drunken sailors and all that. And this has become the stereotype. But in fact, I think that all types of people have always gotten tattoos. It's just in the past they have felt more secretive about them, have felt ashamed of, have been made to feel ashamed of them so that they tend to hide them, you know, so that someone coming back from, say, their career in the Navy and maybe they got a few tattoos, they would go back to some small rural town and the local people, you know, church-going people and all that say, oh, my God, this is awful. This is a barbaric mark. So instead of standing up for it and saying, yes, I got this. This was a sign of real bonding of an experience that I went through. I did my military thing. We were under a great deal of duress. We were in the war or whatever. And being proud of it, they would say, oh, well, yeah, I was drunk and I shouldn't have gotten it. And they would succumb to those kind of mores that were, you know, endemic to their society at large. So a lot of the cliche things just simply weren't widespread, you know, true of the greater tattooed populace.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though, I know you've looked at the history of tattoos a lot. Why has tattooing become such a part of culture at sea or prison culture?
I think, well, particularly in people that are in controlled communities and people that are in uniform, whether in penal institutions or in a military setting, it's a way of extreme individuation, of a way to assert yourself and say, well, they can put me in this uniform, they can give me the military haircut, they can make me talk the talk, but I can get the tattoo. And especially with seafaring people as well, when they were living, whether it was with merchant seamen in the old days on the wooden ships or modern-day sailors, living in extremely tight quarters where your possessions were very, very reduced, you wouldn't have room for a collection of anything that would take up any space, but your tattoos aren't going to take up space, and they'll be with you. You know, it's a sort of mobile, it's like an epidermal diary, you know, of what has gone on in your life. And the tattoos themselves, again, in light of looking at tattooing, say, as a medium, as an art form, you can't consider it strictly in formal terms that you would apply to an inanimate thing that you would apply to a sculpture or a painting, because the tattoo is really just the entry point for the life story of the person that's wearing it. And this is what gives it its real, completes the circuit for a person to say, oh, you know, what an interesting tattoo, or what's that about? When did you get that? Maybe it's not even that great looking a tattoo, but it might have a great deal of meaning to the person wearing it because of the circumstances under which it was done, the person that applied it to them, the thing that it stood for, you know.
My guest is tattoo artist Don Ed Hardy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is tattoo artist Don Ed Hardy. I want to talk more about what it was like for you when you were getting started. You grew up in Southern California, and when you realized how interested you were in tattoos, you hung out at tattoo parlors. What was it like around those tattoo parlors then?
It was very much a typical kind of honky-tonk environment. These shops that I was able to visit were on the Pike in Long Beach. It was an amusement park established in the late 19th century. It was very much the Coney Island of the West Coast, and There were a lot of sailors. Long Beach was a great naval port in those days, and there were, you know, people on holiday. Weekends especially, I would go out and ride the Greyhound up there. It was like a 30-minute ride. And people would come in and pick out tattoos off the flash on the wall. The shops were all quite busy, very brightly lit, very, you know, it was just kind of a honky-tonk amusement park atmosphere. It was very exciting. I thought it was incredible to be in these shops because the images on the wall were, you know, they were bright, they were dramatic, they reflected all these sort of encoded great, you know, emotions that certainly had a tremendous draw to a 10-year-old boy. It was like, wow, look at this stuff, you know, these really wild designs. So I just thought it was fascinating, and it definitely shaped my approach to art, you know, as I kind of went into the fine arts later in life.
There's a great set of pictures of you in one of your books, a book called Rock of Ages. And on the left-hand page, there's a picture of you standing in front of your Lutheran church, and you're wearing a robe and I think a little bow tie or something, looking like quite the choir boy. Mm-hmm. Then on the opposite page is a picture of you, same age, I don't know, you look about 10 or something, mm-hmm. and you have this big tattoo on your chest. It's something that I think that was penciled on, that you penciled on, and mm-hmm. it's a Rock of Ages tattoo. But what a contrast between those two yous. You must have had a foot in two very different worlds.
Yeah, well,
growing up.
I was made to go to church. I mean, my mother really meant well, you know, and she did definitely give me a lot of great grounding in morals and values and all that. I didn't really buy the church party line, but you know, I had to do all that thing, and I just was so obsessed with tattooing. I would sit, you know, in church and draw these tattoo designs on the little programs, and I would request the hymn Rock of Ages because it made me think about being in Long Beach in the tattoo shop. And
yeah, what's the Rock of Ages image in
tattoos? It's this kitsch image that was really like a Courier and Ives style litho that was a religious lithograph that was very popular from, I think they started right around the mid-19th century up probably through the turn of the 20th century, and I think probably millions of them were produced. Found in all sorts of homes, and it was this image of a woman clinging to a big rugged granite cross in the middle of a stormy sea, usually with a sinking, you know, sailing ship in the background. And I could not find out who originated this series of images. There's actually a series of the woman coming out of the water and then being up, hanging on the cross, and another one with two women in it. But I think possibly they were originated by a German artist in the 19th century, but it became a very standard tattoo back piece. The tattoo artist realized that this poster was exactly the right size to do as a back design, and someone got the idea to paint it up as such. So this was in the tattoo shop still when I was a kid. It was really, it sort of lost its popularity maybe from the 30s on, but I was just fascinated by it. I would draw versions of it, and again, because I was press ganged into sort of a, you know, this Lutheran upbringing, and so I was around a lot of crosses and stuff. So that was it.
So when you started to learn how to do tattoos, were you using the same process that you use now, or has there been an advancement in the technology?
There's a greater range of pigments, and there are some fine-tuning adjustments to the machines and that, but essentially the process has stayed the same for, you know, this whole century.
Would you describe a little what the process is for those of us who don't have tattoos?
Yeah, it's a machine that's built pretty much like on the principle of a doorbell with two wire wrap coils and a circuit breaker, a little armature bar at the top. There's a series of very fine needles soldered onto a long bar that runs down through a pen-like kind of a tube that attaches to the power unit. And these vibrate up and down about 3,000 RPM. It runs off direct current, and you dip into the pigment and then draw that on the skin. And it's kind of akin to drawing with colored pencils or something. It requires, of course, a great sureness of hand. And then all the pigments, everything's thrown away at the end of the tattoo. Everything's single service now, of course. Everything's sterilized. We wear gloves. It's all the, you know, precautions are taken that any doctor's office would take.
And how deep do the needles have to go?
It's about a 32nd of an inch. It's into the just the top of the dermal layer. So mm-hmm. a lot of it, I mean, the machines don't really do the work on their own. It's very much up to the touch of the tattoo artist. It's a very sensitive thing. I think skin is an incredibly complex medium to work in because of the variables of it, person to person and one area of the body to another.
So how much of an issue is pain for the average person getting a tattoo?
I think everyone is concerned a great deal about it, although they don't really hurt that badly. It's very hard to equate it to something else. It's a surface burning sensation. I mean, it's not something you'd sleep through, but it's certainly not unbearable. Of course, some areas of the body, you know, center of your chest or on your spine or rib or a more protected area like that, it's more intense, but it's not that big an issue, really.
Mm-hmm. So the pain doesn't bother you when you get it done?
Well, it's not it's not something I enjoy, but and frankly, every time I get a tattoo, I think, oh, geez, I guess I didn't have enough already? I sort of forgot these things hurt, you know, but it's not, it doesn't go on for that long. You know, the tattoo might take 20 minutes, might take an hour, maybe an extreme thing, you'd work for 2 or 3 hours, and it's bearable, and then, you know, then you have it, so you've got it there forever, so I think it's worth going through.
Were you ever in a jam where somebody was about to threaten you, and then they saw your tattoos and thought, well, here's a strange, eccentric guy, I think I'll leave him alone?
Actually, since I believe in the kind of, you know, the shock value of the tattoos, I used to go visit another friend that tattooed on the Lower East Side here in New York, and I was he was on 4th between C and D, which is a pretty bad neighborhood. It certainly was in those days. I don't know how it is these days, but sometimes a cab wouldn't even take us in there. They'd make us get out a couple of blocks before because it was all drug dealers and burnout buildings and very threatening. So just as a matter of course, I made sure I would roll up my sleeves and show that I wasn't just another, you know, dopey white guy walking in there with a big expensive camera, because I was always carrying my camera in to photograph his work and his drawings and all that. And actually, people would see the tattoos and they'd go, oh, you're going to see DeVita, you know, you're going to go down to the tattoo man, because he was known in the neighborhood. He was the tattoo man, and he sort of had this, you know, he was like the shaman's place. He was raised in the Lower East Side. He fit into the environment, but it is an icebreaker in a lot of cultures where they don't identify you perhaps from your perception as a certain race or a certain socioeconomic thing. It identifies you as a member of perhaps a larger, wacky international tribe, you know. I like that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Tattoo artist Don Ed Hardy recorded last year. He co-curated a show of tattoo designs called Pierced Hearts and True Love, A Century of Drawings. It's now at the Williams College Museum in Massachusetts and will travel later this year to Miami, San Francisco, and Cincinnati. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Lydia, roll Lydia, say happy She has eyes that men adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia, Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo, beside it the wreck of the Hesperus too, and proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia.
La la la. La, 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 la.
When a robe is unfurled, she will show you the world if you'll step up and tell her where. For a dime you can see Kankakee or Paris or Washington crossing the Delaware.
La 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 la.
Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. When her muscles start relaxing, up the hill comes Andrew Jackson. That encyclopedia, Lydia, the queen of tattoo. For 2 bits she will do...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yesterday's interview with Stephen Bogart, son of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, made us want to listen back to our interview with Bacall. Coming up, our 1994 interview with her. Also from the archives, an interview with Sally Field. She's starring in the new film Eye for an Eye. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new film Dead Man Walking. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, we heard from Stephen Bogart, son of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. On today's archive edition, we have an interview with Bacall, recorded in 1994 after the publication of her second memoir called Now. It's just come out in paperback. Everyone was knocked out by the 19-year-old Lauren Bacall and her screen debut in the 1944 film To Have and Have Not. 1 year later, she married her leading man, Humphrey Bogart. They had been married over 11 years when Bogart died of cancer. Their screen lives together included the films The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo. Her other films include Young Man with a Horn, How to Marry a Millionaire, Blood Alley, Written on the Wind, Designing Woman, Murder on the Orient Express, The Shootist, Misery, and Ready to Wear. When I spoke with her in 1994, she told me that when Howard Hawks cast her into Have and Have Not, he wanted to make her into his version of the ideal woman.
Well, that ideal was a woman who was could give as good as she got, who had humor, who was kind of a woman of the world and somewhat insolent, and actually who behaved rather like a man.
What did that mean, to behave rather like a man?
Well, that you would look, you know, if a man said something to you, you would look at him directly. And he didn't like shy wallflower types. And always with humor, though, and always somewhat suggestive that something was in the offing, something could happen. And you weren't quite sure what that something was, but you knew that it would be fun and fascinating and probably different, unusual. I mean, he had this incredible thing going on in his brain, and it worked because I was insolent, and he wanted someone as, he always said he wanted someone as insolent as Bogart.
In your first autobiography, and by myself, you
in
wrote...
In the only autobiography.
Well, this is a memoir. Okay, yes. Well, anyways, in that book you write that growing up you thought of yourself as a, quote, nice Jewish girl.
Mm-hmm.
So was there any conflict going on when you got into movies between that, quote, nice Jewish girl that you felt you were brought up to be and this kind of insolent, assertive, sexual woman who you were playing on screen?
No, because I love that. I mean, once you're a nice Jewish girl, you're always a nice Jewish girl, you know. That basic thing never changes, I'm afraid. You never lose that. But no, I didn't think that. I loved doing that. To have an opportunity to be like that, a woman of the world, and insolent, having had adventures. Oh, God, so glamorous. Fabulous.
What did you do early on to convey the sense of mystery that your character had to have?
I don't think I did anything.
And I'm thinking of To Have and Have Not and The
yes.
Big Sleep.
But I don't think I did anything. I think it just happened. I think it was there. You know, there are certain things in one's personality that you're not even aware that you have. There are things that a camera picks up that you don't really know about.
Mm-hmm.
And they convey a certain aspect of your personality that leads you to believe all these things that you want to believe. You know, you can read, an audience reads things into a character and a personality that they really want to read into that person.
You had something that was described as the look. I mean, your eyes were kind of droopy, and you'd look at people with your head lowered a little bit. And
yes, and I'd look up at them.
Yeah, so describe the look a little bit
chin
more
on chest.
And how you got it.
Well, I was terribly nervous during To Have and Have Not. It was quite a terrifying experience for me, and I was this kid, and I was scared to death of all these pros around me, and really had almost no experience on the stage. And certainly none in film. So I was shook when Hawk said action and there was quiet on the set. I'd start to walk into a scene and then my head would shake and my hands would shake. And I discovered that if I kept my head down and looked up, my head would not shake. So I started to do that when I could, when it was appropriate in a scene. And that's how the look came about. But it wasn't that I had planned to have a look. It was just that it was a way to keep my head steady, and that was very important. Terrible to look at another actor while your head is shaking.
What did Humphrey Bogart, who became your husband, teach you about acting when you were starting out?
Well, the one thing that he taught me, the major thing that he taught me, was to think before the scene started. To realize that you had... that you came from somewhere, that something happened before you entered a scene. so that when Howard Hawks said action, your character did not begin with the word action. Your character began before then, so that you came on stage, on screen, into the scene with an attitude, with a point of view, with some weight behind you, instead of aimlessly entering the scene and speaking words. And that was a very valuable thing that he taught me.
I think a lot of people have been a little disappointed by life and by love because they compare it to what they've seen in the movies and it never quite measures up to the movie version. Before you ever really experienced love, you were acting out the movie version of romance. And then you started having the romance with the person who you were acting it out with on screen. And I guess I'm really wondering if there was anything disappointing about the real life version of it, even though it was the same two people who were doing it on screen.
The early romance was the most romantic experience I have ever had in my life, far surpassing anything that I might have dreamed of or imagined. It was quite amazing. I mean, when you are young and when it's your first love and you are just carried away by it and when that's all you can think about. And you see, Bogey was the kind of man who believed in taking care of a marriage and taking care of a relationship. He believed you had to work at it and keep it fresh and fun and interesting, and he did.
He was already a movie star to you, right?
Oh, yes,
when you worked
absolutely.
Together. So you had a sense of him as an icon as well as
no,
a man.
No, not as an icon. He was not my favorite movie star.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Yes, he knew it. No, Leslie Howard was my favorite. Uh-huh. He knew that. But he had worked with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest, which is funny, you know. No, he wasn't an icon when I met him. I mean, he would, because it was after Casablanca, and he was a big star, but certainly not what he is today, which is this legend, this incredible icon now. I mean, he is bigger than ever.
I'm sure you've been asked this a zillion times, but do you think that what you and Bogart were feeling off screen, you can see on screen? I mean, that the real relationship registers in
well,
the movie?
I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly the chemistry registers. Whether it is a consummated relationship or not, I think if there is chemistry between two people, you feel it. I think that Bogey and myself in To Have and Have Not, I think having fallen in love with one another, finally, I think, first of all, it was great for me because it gave him, he wanted me to be good in it, so he made it much easier for me to play the scenes. The feeling was so strong that, you know, originally in To Have and Have Not, his character was supposed to have a little flirtation with the other woman. And once Hawks saw the rushes of the scenes that Bogey and I had played, Bogey said to him, nobody is ever going to accept or believe that he would go off with anybody else for a second. And it was true.
Lauren Bacall is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Now. When you and Bogart decided to get married, you write that he said to you that he wanted to marry you, but only if you were willing to give up going on location for a film because he didn't want you both going off in different directions.
Right.
How do you feel about that in retrospect?
Well, I recognize the fact completely that separation does not breed a happy marriage. I think you must be together. I mean, the reason you get married is to be together, not to be separated. And I think particularly in my profession, but in any profession, I think if you each go off in opposite directions, sooner or later, one of you is going to go off and not come back. And I think that's natural. I agreed to his terms.
But you wanted so much to be an actress.
Right.
And this cut down on the roles that you could take.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I never even got the offers because I was thought of as Bogey's wife and then I would just go with him on location, which I did. And we were never separated. We were separated once only for a very short time.
Well, you know, I was thinking how in a way frustrating it must have been when he was making African Queen with Katharine Hepburn. You were there in Africa with them, kind of suffering through through all of the problems they had to suffer through, but I mean, you were there as the wife. And
I was there as the wife. I was in charge of lunch. No, right.
So
no,
how
but
did
you
that
know,
feel?
I had a lot of frustrations mm-hmm. about my career.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, times where I felt I should have been considered for a part that I wasn't considered for. Bogey had decided early on and told me from the very beginning that he would never interfere with my career, that whatever I did professionally, I would do only with myself and my agent. If I wanted his advice, I could ask him, but that he would never step in, and he never did. And sometimes I thought, well, he ought to step in. I mean, once in a while, I should be in a movie with him that one of the parts is. But whatever his decision was, he was correct because he'd had enough experience to know what worked and what didn't work. And I was very frustrated at times, but I still believe, and I even believed then, that even throughout my frustration, that the choice I made was the right one. Obviously, in view of what happened, it most certainly was the right one. And I'm really happy that I made that choice.
Because your life together
was
short.
Well, because he had a life. He had a life that he never thought he would have. And it was very short, but imagine if I'd gone off somewhere. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have stood for it anyway, so.
After his death, how did that change for you the life you wanted for yourself professionally?
Well, unfortunately, it didn't change very much because, you know, when people get in the habit of not seeing you very much on screen, that habit kind of carries over. And I played in a movie that was very mediocre.
Which movie?
What was it called? I forgot. With Robert Stack, about the little girl with the horse and the gift of love. Wasn't very good. It was a remake, and it wasn't a good remake. And then I went to Europe to be in a movie in England, and India, which of course I loved. And that movie was quite a good movie, but my career never, you see, then I had to leave California. There was no life for me there. And so my career then shifted to the stage. Then, of course, they don't think about you at all in movies.
Right, because you're outside.
Oh, no, oh, she wants to be in the theater. Oh, who cares? We're on to the next.
So what did you do to make it clear that you wanted back in?
Well, I just think if you just keep, hang in there, you know, and just keep working in one medium or another, I have still not gotten my choice of the best roles in the world. There are still friends that don't think of me for parts because we're friends. Well, I mean, that's life. And that's the biz.
Lauren Bacall recorded in 1994. Her memoir, Now, has just been published in paperback. Coming up, Sally Field. This is Fresh Air. Sally Field is starring in the new film Eye for an Eye. She plays a woman who becomes a vigilante after her daughter is murdered and the killer is let off on a technicality. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Field about her early career. She began her acting career starring in the TV sitcoms Gidget and The Flying Nun. It took a while for her to be taken seriously as a film actress, but her work has been rewarded with 2 Academy Awards for her roles as a union organizer in Norma Rae and as a widow struggling to hold her family and her farm together in Places in the Heart. I spoke with her in 1988 after the release of her film Punchline. When you went up to receive your Academy Award for Places in the Heart, you said, sounding surprised, to the audience, you like me. Was it hard for you to feel that you were respected in your field after the TV series that you started off with, the Gidget and the Flying Nun series?
Well, I'm sure that it was and has been in the past, but I think that my particular response to that was just, you know, flat out this sort of enormous feeling you get when either you're getting a standing ovation and you've just given a performance, or your peers, you realize that your peers have voted for you on such an important thing. It, as ridiculous as it sounds, it's an overwhelming feeling of, oh my gosh. And also there was a red light flashing and I had, you know, 2 seconds to say what was really in my heart or just BS everybody. So I just said what the bottom line feeling was, is this sort of overwhelming a feeling of affection and gratitude and letting the people know how deeply it means to you, to any performer who gets that, whether it be a standing ovation for a particular performance or getting an Oscar. Nothing feels the same to a performer.
Mm-hmm. TV audiences were first introduced to you in the role of Gidget. And I was wondering, you know, her personality as this pert, lovable teenager. Were you a teenager at all in that mode?
Oh, yeah. I got Gidget because I was Gidget on one level. I mean, there was another dark level to me that stayed hidden that came out in later work. But the level of me that was the easiest to present to people was the Gidget side of myself. You know, the all-American, giggling little thing, little American girl. And I always was that. I fit into that mold so easily as a young woman growing up in 1964 and the late 1950s. It was someplace for me to feel that I was fine. You know, I fit. It was when Sandra Dee was the number one box office female star, and I seemed to be a place for me to live, as far as I knew, and all the other colors seemed to be totally unacceptable. So Gidget was very easy for me.
Then from Gidget, you played The Flying Nun, which I understand that you first turned down and then accepted.
Who wouldn't? I turned it down. I know that there are people in this country who like it. I don't mean to say that there's anything wrong with them, but I didn't like it. And I did it primarily because I was frightened.
That you'd sink without a trace?
Yeah, that I would. I had several people around me at the time who said, do it, do it. This is all you've got. And I think I was too frightened at the time to reach out for my dreams. But, you know, and that's what it's about. To have the courage to reach out for your dreams. When I was 19 years old and I had done my first television series, I didn't have the guts. I thought I had the talent, and I certainly had the desire to act, but I didn't have the guts to walk away from television and say, go to New York and study and live in a small apartment and do off Broadway, which I think somewhere was my dream, but I was frightened. I was frightened to leave. I'd never been out of California. I'd never been on an airplane, and I was really unsophisticated.
Well, you did something pretty gutsy shortly after The Flying Nun. If I understand this correctly, you fired your agent and your business manager after The Flying Nun. And I was wondering what the last straw was that made you dump them and find other people.
I think it was this the third television series I did called A Girl With Something Extra, which, you see, you don't even know about. So.
That's right.
It had nothing extra whatsoever, except it was, I think, the last straw. It was the final kicker where I said, you know what, I've got nowhere to go except down. So why not just go for the things you want to be? What are you waiting for? And I think that was, I mean, it wasn't like one day I woke up and stretched and said, ah, yes, go for those things. I mean, it was gradual, but it you know, these things, it started to build. It took years and years of it sort of eating away at me and burning a hole in my pocket. Until I realized I had to make a move. I had to go point myself in a different direction.
What was your strategy for doing that?
I don't think I had any strategy at all. I think I was simply going on just sheer instinct. I don't think I had it worked out. I don't think I was really sure as to what feelings were going on inside of me. I was angry at myself and all sorts of things. I had two children. I was supporting the children. I was scared. You know, these things. And having children, you know, as people know, it changes your life. And I had two little children, and I think I just felt if I was capable of taking care of them, then I was capable of taking care of myself. And I think I felt I had to get out and fight for them. And I think that probably propelled me forward.
I think of it as being Sybil. I think of Sybil as being the role that really turned your career around. You got to play a multiple personality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was plenty of opportunities for great acting in something like that.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly my opportunity to really do what I had trained and worked mm-hmm. and so hard to do. I got a break before that, which really got me in to read for Sybil, which was in this little Bob Rafelson film called Stay Hungry with Jeff Bridges and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
That, I think that was my industry kind of break, even though the public didn't see it. And then I got to do Sybil, and I think things started to turn. But it's all very gradual. I don't, you know, still it was a, you know, it was a long time before Norma came along. And it's a long time of just, you know, having to be very certain that you're going to make it, that you've got it.
Sally Field recorded in 1988. She's starring in the new film Eye for an Eye. Coming up, a review of Dead Man Walking. This is Fresh Air. The actor Tim Robbins is familiar from movies like The Player and The Shawshank Redemption, but he also turns out to be a writer-director. His political satire, Bob Roberts, was well-received in 1992, and now he's written and directed a movie based on Sister Helen Prejean's experiences as a nun ministering to prisoners on death row. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Dead Man Walking.
Oddly enough, the star of this movie, Sean Penn, is trying to carve out a career similar to Tim Robbins. Penn has directed two films, The Indian Runner and last year's The Crossing Guard, and now he acts only sporadically. His last appearance before this one was in Carlito's Way in 1993. But unlike Tim Robbins, Penn isn't a very good director. As for his acting, well, even though he refuses to do very much of it, Penn continues to prove with every performance that he's the finest actor of his generation. In Dead Man Walking, he plays Matthew Poncelet, a death row convict in Louisiana accused in a brutal rape and murder. Poncelet claims his innocence, but from the moment we meet him, we feel he must have done it. In a way, Penn is an actor portraying an actor, because even with death by lethal injections staring him in the face, Poncelet never steps out of character. He's a lifelong self-styled tough guy, arrogant, racist, and sly, and his pompadour and nasty little goatee bespeak a man who spends a lot of time making sure he looks the part. At first, Sister Helen Prejean, played by Susan Sarandon, is taken aback at what she sees. Poncelet has written to her in the hope that she might help him find a lawyer and get his sentence commuted. He also, by law, needs a spiritual advisor to help him face execution. Sister Helen takes the job willingly, even though everyone from the families of the victims to the children she works with in a poor neighborhood revile her for it. She visits Poncelet in his cell, and as he tries to con and bamboozle her, she tries to break him down and make him come to terms with who he's been and who he is.
Is your daddy a racist?
What kind of question is that?
We have to teach a child to hate, and I was just wondering who taught you.
I just don't like niggas.
Have you ever known any black people?
Sure, I did. That was all around when I was a kid.
All around?
They lived around me.
Did you ever play with a black child?
No. But me and my cousin got jumped pretty good once.
What happened?
We was throwing rocks at them. So the next day, they wait that chance, get a hold of our bikes, tear them up.
Can you blame them?
Well, no, but look, slavery's long over. They always harping on what a bad deal they got.
The kids that tore up your bike?
All of them. I can't stand people make themselves out to be victims.
Victims?
Yeah, they're all victims.
I don't know any victims in my neighborhood. I know some pretty cool people, decent, hardworking.
Yeah, I know a lot of lazy, welfare-taking coloreds sucking up tax dollars.
You sound like a politician.
What's that mean?
You ever been the object of prejudice?
No.
What do you suppose people think about inmates on death row?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me?
They're all monsters. Disposable human waste. Good for nothing, sucking up tax dollars.
Yeah, but I ain't no victim. They gonna kill me. I'm innocent. I ain't whining. I ain't sitting on no porch going slavery. I like rebels. Some blacks is okay. Martin Luther King, he led his people all the way to D.C. kicked the white man's butt.
You respect Martin Luther King?
Now, he put up a fight. He wasn't lazy.
What about lazy whites?
Don't like him.
So it's lazy people you don't like.
Can we talk about something else?
That scene borders on preachiness. And in fact, a lot of Dead Man Walking does. It never quite takes off as a piece of storytelling. Still, you have to admire the film's intellectual honesty. This is an anti-capital punishment movie that's so even-handed that a lot of viewers will come away not quite sure where the film stands. The anguish of the victims' families is given latitude and respect, and Robbins hasn't made the usual cheap mistake of pretending that the killer might be innocent. He doesn't minimize the crime either. In fact, he shows it to us in all its stomach-churning horror, but he also sets it up as a parallel to the state's much colder, more clinical taking of a life. The movie plunges you into a sea of emotions, but then, unexpectedly, it pulls you out the other side. And this is where Dead Man Walking departs from the Hollywood mainstream. Susan Sarandon's performance turns out to be a very moving portrayal of spiritual struggle, and it engages the audience in a similar struggle. Just as Sarandon peers wide-eyed into the face of evil, looking for the spark of redeemable humanity there, so do we. And, like her, eventually we find it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.